This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Simone Amelia Jordan, welcome to Better Reading.
Thank you so much, Cheryl. It is an absolute honour.
Yeah, wow. So we met in unusual circumstances. I think you tracked me down through Instagram, didn't you?
I realised very quickly on Instagram that you and I seem to have a lot in common and I wanted to connect with you and get to know you better. So social media is the way we do that these days.
Isn't that strange? Do you know, I have now, and I don't know if this is a coincidence, but I've met two people now via Instagram, because I'm a lot older than you, so it's not my form of contact usually, but she's young as well.
What is pigeons?
Karima from Sunday Kitchen. Do you know her?
Oh, I do know her, and we met on Instagram as well.
She is an Instagram stalker, I think.
I was at a dinner
and I said to her, how did I meet you? I'd just forgotten how I met her. And she said, oh, I stalked you on Instagram. I said, oh, right, yeah, that's how.
Well, I guess that's how you meet. You know, you get to know people, you watch their profiles, you see what they're talking about, their views. It's almost kind of a cheat code, really, to getting to know someone in a way. Yeah.
Do you know, I know social media has a lot of negatives and it gets a lot of flack. I understand all of that, and a lot of the criticism is correct and a lot isn't. But I have two views around it. One is I've met really nice people. Right. Mm. But also, too, I feel as though your Instagram, whether you like it or not, is a representation of the real you. Even if you're trying to hide it with, you know, beautiful photos, nice loaves of bread, it says a lot about the person, I think. And I can always see through it. I mean, you know, sure, if it's a cosmetic account or this account or whatever, no, I can't. But if you're doing your own Instagram page, I know a lot about you. And Facebook, well, that's where our book reading community is. You know, we've got over 300,000. And that to me is a fine example of what Facebook is meant to be, where it's sharing ideas and stories and whatever. So there are some positives. And now I would say Palestine and Gaza, because if we didn't have social media, Simone, you know this and I know this, you know, the mastheads weren't doing their job. They're only coming on board now.
Listen, I think as someone who has worked in the media for my entire career, Cheryl, I have not watched mainstream news since October 7 because I knew that there would be absolutely no background given to the horrendous attack that happened that day. Mm. I knew that there would be no history, no contextualization of why it happened. And I think we were saying earlier off mic that there is a huge disconnect between older generations that get their news from mainstream versus a majority of younger people, but there are older people on socials all the time too that are seeing very close up what's going on the ground. So,
well, yeah, I mean, I had been a subscriber to the New York Times for some years and I unsubscribed. I mean, they were not just not doing their job. I think they were showing incredible bias. Again, not giving any context. But anyway, let me just introduce you first, because I think this is going to, we're going to have a very big chat, lots of places to go. So in a way, Simone stalked me. So here we are. It turned out that she has a book and it's called Tell Her She's Dreaming. Simone grew up on the Central Coast, the whitewashed Central Coast in the 1980s. Lebanese Australian. Do you call yourself a Lebanese Australian or an Australian Lebanese?
So I grew up for a couple of years on the Central Coast, but I mainly grew up in the inner west. But when I moved from the Central Coast was my huge culture shock, which is where the book starts. I'm Lebanese and Greek Cypriot background, but I do find it a little bit weird saying what I am because my family has been here for three generations. And so you start to think, can I represent somewhere that I've been once, I barely speak the language, but the book details how much I love and revere this Lebanese culture because it's my mother's side of the family. My parents got divorced when I was very little, so I had no connection to the Greek Cypriot side. And, yeah, it's all about kind of chasing that identity. And I say in the introduction, where most girls I grew up with ran away from their Lebanese heritage, I ran towards it. I was so hungry to be Lebanese because our family was so far removed. Because my great grandparents came here in the early 1930s.
So yours goes further back. My parents came in the 1950s.
Yeah, so we've been here quite a long time. And they moved at a time, obviously, when the White Australia policy and you just weren't really able to be proud of who you were at all. So it got drummed out of my great-grandparents and my grandmother. My grandmother was 10 when she arrived with them. And so, but get to my generation. And I'm like, I want to eat all the Lebanese food. I want to say all the Lebanese curse words. I want to learn belly dancing. I want to do all the tropes because I was obsessed with finding my culture. So, yeah, it was an interesting experience. And then you throw in the hip-hop culture that I grew up on and, a mixed bag of tricks, definitely.
Okay, I want to come back to identity, but I'll finish the introduction. Amelia felt like an outcast among her peers for years. Her lifeline was hip-hop. Then in its golden age. From girlhood, Simone recognised the art form's pro-black consciousness and the rapper's resonate words inspired her to embrace her own identity and back herself. From founding Australia's most successful hip-hop and R&B publication to moving to New York City and interviewing the biggest stars of the time as the editor of the world's most beloved rap magazine, Simone's inspiring story is about defying the odds to reach for your dreams. Tell Her She's Dreaming, the book, is a deeply personal story of family, culture, and music that disrupts the long-held view that women, and racially diverse women especially, are limited in their power as bold, playful explorers. Okay, I want to know firstly how you came to write this book and how you got a publishing contract, because that's not easy.
No, it's not. I never thought I'd get the chance to write this book, but I always knew it was inside me. And so the Ritual Prize, which Hachette Australia runs.
Oh, the
Matt
Ritual Prize. Yeah.
I knew that. Oh, wow.
Yeah. I know his wife.
By all accounts, he sounded like a great person.
I've got to tell you, he was one of my favourite people in the industry and I had dinner with him not long before he died. And I'm friends with his beautiful widow.
Hannah gave person. I haven't met Hannah in person. She gave a beautiful speech. She's very encouraging every year. Gorgeous. Of the winners of this prize. Yeah. So I saw we were in COVID lockdown and it was 2021 and it was 1 month before the deadline. And I remember the tagline was be bold, be fearless, you know, enter your work. And I thought, Cheryl, you know what? I've lived a life now. I'm in my early 40s. I think I've got some lessons that I can share, not in a preachy way, with women, young women especially, from multicultural backgrounds. And so in that month, the entry called for three chapters, the first three chapters, an overview of the rest of the book, summary, setting, all this stuff. Now, I've been a music journalist for decades, but writing creative nonfiction is a whole nother beast. And so I basically had to teach myself a craft in a very short amount of time. So I did that. I immersed myself for a month. I drove my husband and daughter insane, but I gave it my all and I somehow eventually won and beat 850 people and won the Ritual Prize in 2021. And then, so
that's
that was three chapters.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I still can't believe it. And my mum, she's so funny. She's so down to earth. She's like, every time I said, Ma, I made the short list or I made the long list, then I made the short list. She's like, what? Our story's not that interesting. I'm like, well, I think it is because it's getting somewhere. And then, yeah, so I won that. And then I wrote an extra two chapters because the Ritual Prize includes mentorship. And I had the incredible Vanessa Radnich at Hachette as my mentor, and she's still
my
mentor.
Gosh, you hit the jackpot.
I hit the jackpot. One of the most genuine, loving people I've ever met.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Yeah, she truly is. And so after five chapters, she went in and pitched it and said in the acquisitions meeting, so I'm learning all these new terms, and she said, we're happy to offer you an agreement. And so here we are. This is a story of someone that I always felt very singular in who I am and what I do. And I couldn't believe that this story was going to be told across Australia and New Zealand. And now, actually, this month, the beginning of February, it's gone on sale in the UK as well. And it's all crazy. And final destination is hopefully the US, where I spend a lot of time, which I'm sure we'll get into. So, yeah.
Okay, so it is a memoir. So I want to talk about, firstly, about growing up, and I want to talk about identity, because we are very similar. I mean, my parents, I think I said this, they came in the 50s, and there's six people in my family, six kids, siblings, and four of the siblings were born in Lebanon and two of the siblings were born here, in Sydney. That's me and my sister Margaret. But definitely in terms of identity, I grew up feeling different and feeling definitely on the outer. I would, you know, we grew up in Glebe and it wasn't very multicultural. And so lots and lots of stories of hardship and racism that were very poor. You know, my parents were struggling, you know, with that. I've said this before, but I'll tell you, you probably don't know it, but my parents came from Sarte, the north of Lebanon, near Tripoli. And there was a man called Antoine Andlofet, and he had immigrated earlier, and there was this community of Lebanese Australians, and they owned a butcher in Redfern. And on top of the butcher was one room, one kitchen, one bathroom. And as families arrived into Sydney, he would let them have that space until they found their feet. And we were there for over a year. Six kids and two adults, one room, one bathroom, one kitchen. Oh, and they were happy days.
Absolutely. My great-grandfather was one of the first men to come from his village, Bairn. It's a really small village.
Whereabouts?
Bairn is in the north. It's next to Bishari. Yeah, next
to Prasol. Yeah.
Those northerners, they like to pack up and leave back in those days, but when he got here, he was sponsoring all new families to come through from Bairn. So I sometimes think, like, where would I be without, like, people like your parents or my grandparents, great-grandparents, considering the state of our motherland at the moment, and those sacrifices that they made really made me. And I talk about that in the introduction of the book. My grandmother was she had seven kids, and she had an alcoholic husband, physically abusive. She worked three jobs. She used to work on Sydney Railways at Redfern. She used she used to work on the railways. She was a machine attendant. She did, she worked there for over 40 years, with seven children and a husband that didn't contribute very much at all. And so she was a hard worker, salt of the earth, very resilient. Whereas my mum, who's one of her seven children and in the middle, is a bit more of a dreamer. My mum was born here, so she was afforded, you know, she still went through a lot. She was born in the 1950s, so she went through her fair share of racism and discrimination. But, you know, she was afforded a little bit more than my grandmother was. So she wanted to be in the circus. That was her big dream. And she was a bit more of a dreamer, not so much of a doer.
What was she going to do in the circus?
Oh, she wanted to fly on the trapeze. You know, it's so sad.
Because her father
was very, very strict, very old school, made her leave school at 14, didn't believe girls should be doing anything but working in a factory or cleaning the house. She had these big dreams that she never got to realise. And I always say I'm the legacy of my mum and my grandmother, because I was able to see because my mum raised me as a single mother. My father and her divorced when I was very little. So I was raised by my mum and my grandmother, and the combination of those two women, a dreamer and a doer, made me achieve so much in life. So I'm very grateful for that.
Talk to me about, because, I mean, you know, I guess a little bit in terms of, I don't know a lot about hip hop, right? And for me to see a Lebanese Australian interested in hip hop was quite a surprise.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. So
it could be generational as well, because I'm a lot older than you.
Yeah, that could be. Well, hip hop in Australia took off in the early 80s around the Burwood area, you know, very much an inner west thing because it was much more working class, as we know.
Is that right?
Then. Yeah. And so it's always been extremely multicultural, and Lebanese Australians have been part of it from day one, alongside, you know, African immigrants, Polynesian immigrants, Southeast Asian immigrants. So, yeah, I loved hip hop since I was a child. I felt like it spoke to me. My parents, my aunties, my family always loved R&B soul music, you know, from the 70s growing up, early 80s. Disco, they were into, had all those good, cool records, Shalamar and all these groups. So growing up in the inner west, when I was 8 to 9, we moved to the Central Coast. My mum, my grandmother and my little sister, because we lived on Parramatta Road in Summerhill, and my sister had a really bad cough. She had asthma. And they thought, well, let's move to the beaches. It might be better for her. So that was a huge culture shock at that age, to be kind of ripped out of this melting pot and thrown into Home and Away, basically. So hip hop became my best friend, because hip hop at that point was about empowerment and about being, you know, self-pride. And I understood that these Black artists, with their pro-Black consciousness, were speaking to their people. But I was, I guess, canny enough to interpret it for my own message, right? So from a very young age, I've always revered African Americans as a community, not only just for hip hop, but obviously for the strides that they make and the rest of us follow when it comes to fighting racism and all of the movements that we all sort of pick up on after they lead the way. But with hip hop especially, you know, the lyrics made me fall in love with words.
So even if you were, how many generations Australian did you say? 5 generations?
Three. Well, my grandmother came here when she was 10, so three.
Okay.
Yeah.
That you still felt a point of difference to others.
Absolutely.
Right?
And funny, because I don't speak Arabic or Greek.
Oh, wow. There you go.
Yeah, but when I moved to the Central Coast, there's examples in the book where we invited, because, you know, Cheryl, we're, you know, with neighbours, and as soon as we moved in the house, we thought, well, why aren't they inviting us over? Like, this is what we do. We invite people over.
I'm like that here in the US, and people think I'm strange.
You know? Like, why aren't these people sort of saying, come in for coffee, come in? Like, my uncle's a truck driver, so there'd always be pineapples from Queensland. Come in for a pineapple, come in. Anyway, but no one was inviting us, so we invited the lady next door over. And my grandmother was making kibbeh on the stove, and I'll never forget, as a child, I'm sitting at the kitchen table and this woman goes, she put her hand over her mouth and she's like, oh, my God, ew, what is that? And I saw my grandmother's face, like, just so dejected. And I recognised at a very young age what racism can do to a person and how it can knock the wind out of you. And I say in the book, as I'm sure you know, you don't know how you're going to react to each individual racist episode, because you react differently sometimes. Sometimes you're just like my grandmother was, because she's feisty, my grandma. She'll give it to the best of people. But in that moment, I saw her cower because the breath had been knocked out of her. She was so shocked that this woman of her age could act like that, be so ignorant, right? And then other times, you just go, you know, you could react violently. You don't know how you're going to react to those incidents. So, yeah, I learned very early on, and I was called WOG multiple times up there, and I'd never heard that word before. It's funny.
You know what happened to you, I think? Because we were brought up in Glebe, and by the time your generation came, you probably weren't going to experience racism in the to the same degree, right?
No.
So what experiencing up the Central Coast, what I was experiencing in Glebe when I was a child.
100%.
Don't you think? Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Just want to go back to food a little bit, because that memory just came to me while talking to your grandma. We lived in Glebe on Dargan Street. We had a corner shop, and my mother, she cooked, she sewed glow mesh purses as well. And my dad worked in a factory. I mean, this is what it took for those people.
Of course.
To get ahead.
Yeah.
But she was always, you know, she was sending us to neighbor's house to pick vine leaves, and, you know, we'd always come back with a bowl of vine leaves for the neighbor that we pulled the vine leaves from. But this Chinese family moved in, and my mum noticed that they were isolated, right? Now, the woman couldn't speak English, and my mother didn't have a lot of English. But, you know, they used to exchange food, and then they started teaching each other different recipes. So we started eating Chinese food. And do you know, I still cook one of those dishes.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that a magical connection? Yeah.
Oh, I just, and I love
language. No language.
Yeah. And do you know how heartening that is to hear, because so many immigrants shut the door behind them on the new arrivals. So to hear that your mother and family embraced the newer arrival, it's so heartening, because I, you know, I remember speaking to a man. I was working at Channel 10 for a little while, and one of our security guards, he had just arrived from Pakistan, and we're talking about issues and immigration. And Cheryl, this man was waiting for his visa and was saying we should shut the gates. I'm like, bro, you're not even in yet. Like, you know, like it blew my mind.
It makes me crazy.
That, as they call it now, like lateral violence, in terms of I'm okay, I don't care about the next person. That drives me insane. So that's a beautiful story.
I love it. I just remembered it. Yeah. So you get expelled once, twice. I'm a different generation. You could not get expelled in my house. You would have been in big trouble.
Oh, well, I'll explain what happened and why it was the opposite for me. So in year six, I was awarded a scholarship to a private school in the inner west, and that was a huge deal. I knew I wanted to be a journalist already. I was smart, and I was one of those annoying smarties that never paid attention in class and was a chatterbox and a bit of a rabble rouser, but always did pretty good in my schoolwork. So I got this scholarship, and it was a dream come true for me, because I knew I wanted to be a journalist even back then. Dream come true for my mum as a single mum. And the school was a nightmare, turned out to be a nightmare. I was bullied incessantly from day one. They told me, don't tell anyone you're on a scholarship, because, you know, you just want to keep something like that private. But Cheryl, how do you keep that private? People see where you live. You meet girls. They know. And why should you? You know, why shouldn't you be proud of who you are? And so I was tormented for 2 and a bit years. And then in the beginning of year nine, it all came to a head with the bully of the school. I always say it's so strange that Looking for Alabrini came out in 1992, and then I lived it. I literally lived that movie almost in many ways in the beginning of 95, I believe that was, when I got expelled. And Melina Marquetta went to Rosebank, which is where I ended up after I got expelled.
Do you know Melina?
No, I don't, and I was just told.
I do.
Well, like, you know everybody.
Hey, listen, you know what I'm going to do when I get back?
Yeah.
We're going to get together, and I'll get you in touch with Melina.
I
stalked Melina for years. She worked at Target at Leichhardt, after the book came out, and I read the book and I loved it so much, and I was working in a library, and I would just go to Target to watch her serve
people. In Marketplace. Yeah.
Yeah, to serve people. All she was doing. And then I only really just met her quite recently.
And you called me a bloody stalker in the beginning of this. That's pretty intense.
It just wasn't social media. It was in-person stalking. And I met her for the first time. It would have been before COVID, but maybe only 5 or 6 years ago. And now we're besties.
Oh, I believe it. I was just speaking. Her ears must be burning because this morning I was speaking to Rosebank because I'm doing a keynote for them for International Women's Day and coming back.
Oh, wonderful.
To talk to the kids. And they said that they had asked her to do a panel with me on it. But they said she doesn't like to do a lot of speaking engagements. She had declined. And I was like, oh, no, because, like, I would die to meet her. So,
I can make that happen for you.
Oh, thank you. You're like the fairy Lebanese godmother. I love it.
Well, do you know Karima has me in her phone as fairy godmother?
Oh, wow. See, great minds. Great minds. There you go.
There you go.
Well, yeah, so. Okay.
All right. So you're at the school.
That's what happened.
So you've been bullied.
I'm at the school, been bullied, and she physically attacked me, and she said, what are you going to do about it? Knowing that she'd been harassing me, knowing I was on a scholarship, knowing there wasn't really much I could do about it. And so I beat the shit out of her. And then I got expelled and she was allowed to stay. And her father donated a BMW to the school raffle. Yeah. So that was a really hard time for me because I was already hanging out in Burwood doing teenage things. And my mum thought, well, that's the end of it. You know, Simone's gone. She's not going to be on a path to whatever. But Mr. Hawley was a beautiful Irish man. He was the principal of Rosebank and he took me in. And then I ended up becoming the school captain there. And, you know, the rest is history. But
Tell me, because, you know, we will run out of time. So I just want to get to the New York bit.
Yeah,
why New York and how did that happen?
New York, I felt like, was my spiritual home. It was somewhere I'd always wanted to live since I was young. I mean, I fell in love with hip hop as a child, and that's the mecca, as they say, for hip hop music. And I started after high school, I went to uni. I went to UTS and did journalism. And straight out of uni, I started Australia's first hip hop and R&B magazine because I was applying for cadetships at the ABC and SBS. And even though I had more experience than all of the other students, because I was already working at that point for a magazine publisher called Terra Planet at Juice Magazine, which was a music magazine, I was getting knocked back.
We've seen how the ABC have behaved recently. So, I find that deeply disappointing.
Oh, look, I work for Media Diversity Australia now, and my job is running programs to get young journalists from multicultural backgrounds in the industry. But at the same time, we're fighting for their cultural safety while they're there. So I started my own thing. You know, as I say, I didn't want to sit at the table. I made my own table. And I started a hip-hop and R&B magazine, did that for a number of years, somehow parlayed that. That's such a hip-hop word, parlayed. I parlayed that into an opportunity in New York City to work for the biggest online retailer of urban fashion because hip-hop clothing was a whole big thing back then. And they gave me the job as their inaugural content and lifestyle manager. And they flew me from Australia to New York for 3 days for the job interview. And when I said to them, why me? Like, this is the home of hip-hop journalism. Why me from Australia? They said, you are a hustler. You have built a magazine about this culture on the other side of the world in a not very welcoming environment. And we feel like you could do some great things here. And my bosses were just amazing, just amazing. And so in January 2007, I landed in the middle of winter with the proverbial suitcase and a dream, and I got to stay for 10 years and it was just an incredible time.
So did they, I mean, because, you know, that's hard. I mean, New York's not cheap. They put you up? What kind of financial support did you get to set up?
Yeah, not too much. I mean, they supported me maybe, I think it was the first month they looked after for rent while I was, I was in a hotel for the first 2 weeks looking for an apartment. I knew I wanted to live in Harlem, so I found something in Harlem straight away. And the salary was really good, Cheryl. When I think about back then, I was 26, 27, and I think I was on like maybe $60,000 to $70,000 US in 2007. Plus a 10 grand bonus at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. So it was incredible. And I was doing what I loved. I got to start a blog on their website. I started on camera interviews. I was interviewing like people that are huge stars now, Nicki Minaj, all these rappers and singers.
I've heard of her.
Yes, I knew you would. That's why I'm like, let me think of someone Cheryl will know. So it was a great run, Cheryl. And then I had some bumps towards the end. And then I came down very sick with Crohn's disease. And So that's why my mum, after 10 years, was like, look, you've had a great run. I was literally life or death with that illness. And the American healthcare system, as you know, is evil. So, and Australia isn't getting any easier either. So it was time to come back.
And how did you feel about coming back? Because in the time that I do it, and I'm only 3 months, right, and I go back and forward and I still have a home, but there's always a transition period of kind of working your way back in, you know, because it's the shock of the new, the shock of the difference.
Oh, absolutely.
Different lifestyle. And I've said this before, you know, I feel that the only thing I have in common with my American friends is language. Everything else culturally is so different.
Well, when I came home, everyone was saying to me, you worked in media in New York City for 10 years. You will get a job in Australia straight away. Would you believe, Cheryl, and I knew it was going to be hard. No one cared where I worked. There is a huge disconnect, especially when it comes to hip hop culture and music journalism. I mean, music journalism was on its way out slowly, you know, but when I got home at the end of 2016, now it's on, you know, flat line at the moment. It was really hard, like career-wise it was hard to get my bearings. And then also culturally, I felt like, where am I? Where do I belong? I got home and I'm turning on the TV, the Today Show Sunrise, this is 2016, still looked as white as it did when I was a little girl. I said nothing's changed in 10 years. Mm. And then, you know, as fate would have it, the CEO, Lila Nahnuls, of Diversity Arts Australia, and then Antoinette Latouf, who was the co-CEO of the co-founder of Media Diversity Australia, got in touch with them, ended up working with both organisations and just finding my feet again. But, you know, that took time. It definitely took time.
And did you meet your partner here? Can I talk about that? Can I?
Of course.
Tell me.
That is a story of hope for anyone out there that needs it. I came home very single. I had dated every dickhead under the, can I swear? Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. You
can swear. Every dickhead under the sun in New York. And my grandmother, God bless her, my sitta, when I got home, she said, you're on the shelf now. You're old and no one wants you. Got to love straight-talking Lebanese grandmothers.
Yeah, yeah. Because you're on the shelf after 21, aren't you?
You're on the shelf. And I was in my late 30s. I was gone.
Yeah, yeah. Way gone.
Way gone. But in the book, I talked about how my sister says when my health got better, she said, let's go on Tinder. And I said, Tinder? How embarrassing. She was like, bro, no one knows you here. Calm down. Anyway, I love my family. And so I went on there. Cheryl, the first day, I said, all right, I'll swipe a few times. He pops up. It says he's from Harlem. He's in Australia. And I said, oh, okay, you know what? Honestly, even if we become friends, I'm sure we've got a lot in common because we'll understand each other, right? And so I swiped. He swipes back. He calls me. He's like, I'm old fashioned. I want to call you. And the rest is history. We're married. We've got an almost 6-year-old daughter. And we understand each other on a very beautiful level where we don't really feel like we belong in one place. And we have a lot in common.
You meet him in Harlem? That would have been a better story.
I know, but he always says to me, Simone, well, this is what's so funny. He was living here in Australia when I was in the States, and he went to a party on my block at the National Black Theatre in Harlem. That's the same block I lived on. And he said, we could have crossed paths in the street. Wow. He said, but you wouldn't have liked me back then because I'm a nice guy and you weren't dating and you weren't dating nice guys. And you know what? I wasn't, Cheryl. Like, I had to grow up a lot, you know, to appreciate who he is. So, yeah.
Now, listen, Simone, we're out of time. I knew this would happen. The book is called Tell Her She's Dreamin'. Yeah. Congratulations. It's available.
You've got to have the Aussie saying, Aussie accent, right? Tell her she's dreaming. Yeah.
She's dreaming. Congratulations. And I feel that one of the happy moments, I guess, that have come out of what's happening in Palestine, because it's, as you and I both know, it's complete horror.
Yes.
Is that I've connected with some really beautiful people and you're one of them.
Yes. Oh, amen. Oh, don't make me cry. I feel the same. It is the only light that's come out of this most horrific situation I've ever witnessed in my life is knowing that a lot of people have let me down, but a lot of people have, you know, reignited my faith as well. So it's been an absolute honour to meet you, and you are a fairy godmother. So we're grateful for you.
Thank you, lovely.
You're welcome.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au. This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere. Or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.